There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
A very good evening. You are listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap with me, Richard Dean. Coming up in the next hour, we're talking ethics on the back of public relations firms declining to work for the Hong Kong government amid the protests. Our question today is this: have you ever turned down a lucrative contract for ethical reasons, even though it was perfectly legal? Plus, as the UAE football season kicks off this weekend, we hear from experts about how the Emirati League plans to attract more fans, including expats. First up, though, how do you sell a $2 million sports car?
I was down at the launch of the Lotus Evea. We spoke to the global CEO of Lotus yesterday, just before the launch. And I went down there and had a very pleasant afternoon indeed, looking at shiny, expensive sports cars, including the new Lotus Evea, which is a $2 million electric hypercar. I also got the chance to sit down with the CEO, Carl Heimer, who is the CEO of Adamas Motors. Now, that is the company that is bringing Lotus and the new car here to the UAE. And I asked Carl, how do you even go about selling a $2 million car? This is what he said.
Well, as you know, in the UAE, we have the most discerning car buyers in the world. A lot of them are better informed than most of the people working in the garages. This is limited, it's only 130, but this all-electric car is the fastest electric car in the world, 2,000 brake horsepower, and 0 to 100 under 3 seconds. But at the same time, it's the future. The UAE is about the future. We talk about sustainably smart city. This is an all-electric car. It's as fast as a Formula One. And we will go about selling it. We have private showings for VVIPs. Of course, it's a VVIP car. They're unique, they're bespoke, they're handmade. And there's 130 worldwide. And we hope to sell 15 and be the number one dealer in the world.
Talk me through what will happen with these VVIP showings.
So what we've done now, we have private viewings both in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. Some we're taking to people's private residences because it's exclusive, and some are coming into our showrooms both again in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. We started 3 days ago. We've taken 4 orders already. The quicker we get the order, the better, because they can get an individual chassis number, be number 1 or number 6 or number 7. And the UAE loves that. So there'll be 1 hour private viewings with the designer, with the head of sales and the Adamas team. They'll be seen around the car, because these are bespoke cars, so when people order, they get exactly what they want.
What kind of deposit do you have to put down on this car?
No, not very much. €250,000. And we'll get you the production slot for 2020. And it's very important. The US sold 13 when it was in California. There's 20 sold worldwide already. It's going to China next. Let the UAE beat China. The first to pay the deposit gets the car, and they will be made over the next 2-3 years. So if we can take the deposits now and let them spec the cars to their personal choice now, they can get the cars in 2020. So we can be the first.
What options are available for speccing the cars? How individual can one make it?
Well, of course, when you're spending 8 million plus dirham, they can be very individual because it's handmade, bespoke for you as the customer. I have to say this car, however, when you see it, you know, if you follow this car down the Sheikh Zayed Road or around the Corniche in Abu Dhabi, you'll think you're behind an F-16 jet. There's nothing like it in the world. So you can make the car exactly what you want, where you have the British flag and saying it about the first hypercar to come out of Britain. You can put diamond encrusting in that. The logo on the front, that comes in carbon fiber. You can make it titanium, whatever you want. The spine down the seats of the car. It has the car for the drivers written, but you can put your family crest, whatever you want. These cars, colors, specs, paint finishes, can be very individual. But you don't need to be that individual with a car that's 2,000 brake horsepower and up to 350 kilometres an hour. This car's faster than the Formula One.
Where in the UAE, though, can someone really experience the full power of this car?
Of course, we have to think about safety. We have to think about other road users. There's not a single road we can do 350 kilometres an hour. However, last weekend I took 50 customers to Dubai Autodrome for a track day. We can take the cars on the tracks. Yes, they're going to be supervised, but we can take them. I'm taking 20 of my McLaren customers to Silverstone. So my McLaren's from Hong Kong. They don't have a Formula One racetrack. They can come into England. We can track the cars. So there are ways. But of course, you can drive well within the speed limit in these cars and still drive a beautiful, unique car. And you can feel the car, the driving of the car, the handling of the car. And still, you can have a lot of fun.
What's the appetite here for electric cars?
The last 6 months, it's amazing. 6 months ago, they wanted hybrid, normal combustion engines, but now people are talking about them. I think governments are driving around the world, and so they should. And particularly this part of the world, we like to be first at what we do. And of course, people that buy my cars are collectors. And they realize if you want a really good collection, you need an electric car, hypercar. And it's different when you have a mass-produced car. We lose money, we know. Cars cost money. But the individual cars that are rare, I saw a Scaglietti 1967 sold for $20-odd million in the US. It probably only cost a few thousand. These are unique cars. You can enjoy it. People buy them for the enjoyment and drive, and some people buy just to collect it like you would a painting. So they see appreciating value. There's only 130 of these. And if you get the right chassis number on the car and you get the right specification, it has a very strong future value.
Let's look at how Lotus is doing in the UAE. It's been just over a year since you opened your showroom here in Dubai. How have sales been?
August last year, we opened with Lotus. Lotus were bought by Geely a few months before I acquired it. We knew when we bought the business that they're going to bring in a lot of new product. So we, in the first year, have had only the old cars, the Evora and the Exige. But actually been quite surprising. We've even had supercar owners clubs asking if Lotus will go and join. We're having lots of breakfast meetings where all the Lotus owners are coming. We've done 40 in 12 months, which I think is a lot more than some very established car at the moment with the market as it is. So maybe we're setting up the best time.
How's the brand recognition for Lotus here in the UAE?
It was hard at first, and particularly with younger people. If you're looking 40, 50s, upwards, they know the brand very, very well. But we've had a few very prominent people buy the cars recently. They're bringing their friends in. We start at 305,000 dirham, and they're going up to about 650,000 at the moment. And now people are looking at their money a little closer and being sensible. And we think this is a sensible sports car.
And that is Carl Heimer, the CEO of Adamas Motors, the company that has brought Lotus here to the UAE and is bringing the $2 million Lotus Evora.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm Richard Dean.
We're talking about doing the right thing or not doing the right thing, as the case may be.
Ethics.
This is on the back of the situation in Hong Kong. Last month, Hong Kong put out a request for proposal to eight of the world's leading public relations companies to help burnish the image of Hong Kong, which has taken a bit of a hit during the protests that have been going on throughout the summer. However, all eight companies declined to bid for that contract. So we're asking you, have you ever turned down a lucrative contract for ethical or conscience reasons, even though it was perfectly legal? And so far on our Twitter poll, it seems that quite a lot of you have. That's a specific question we've been asking. We're giving you a binary choice. So far, 7 out of 10 say, yes, my conscience is clear. 3 out of 10 say, no, money talks. I would take the contract.
Look, I mean, I've never worked in PR, but I would have thought that with the current mood around the world, that I would have leapt at a contract that eight other agencies had turned down. A, but you could name your own price pretty much. And one of the things that the Hong Kong government wanted them to do was to underscore the strengths and attributes that differentiate Hong Kong from other cities in the region and bring out the success of one country, two systems. That's the reference to China there. You know, very much in the sort of the way of Asia, Malaysia, truly Asia, that sort of thing. Come up with a tagline, sell Hong Kong as a destination. Is it too soon after the troubles on the streets that seem to be subsiding slightly in the last couple of weeks? Most of those agency felt it was. But I could see an opportunity here if you're a hungry young agency to get in there and do that.
I mean, it's not quite PR, but if I look at the decisions that I've made, the times that I've turned something down, I can remember in the heyday of Dubai's property-ness before 2008, when people were looking at building some quite exceptional structures, shall we say. I can remember going to the press launch of someone wanting to build a freestanding transparent dome in the desert, fill it with snow and penguins and a snowball maker that would make perfect snowballs every time. Those are the days of which I speak.
The days of the cooled beaches.
They are indeed. Around that time, I had someone approach me to ask if I would be effectively the voice of a property company and do their videos and everything. And I can remember looking at it and thinking, no, probably not, actually. I think it always is in these things. It's partly ethics and it's partly self-interest. I didn't really hugely want to be associated with. I also thought, by the way, as you know, hosting the business breakfast, it wasn't necessarily a great thing for me to be the voice of one property developer when we obviously interview lots of property developers. But if it all didn't work out, I didn't want my voice to be associated with it.
And that's what these public relations companies are concerned about, because it's just 2 years, almost 2 years to the day, since Bell Pottinger collapsed amid similar circumstances. Bell Pottinger, September 2017, put into administration after the PR firm suffered an exodus of clients and increasing losses in the wake of the scandal over a campaign to stir up racial tensions in South Africa.
So the Guptas and Jacob Zuma. Yeah.
That is correct, yeah. Bell Pottinger, for many, many years, one of the big names of this kind of government advisory communications industry. In many ways, it was the kind of Rolls Royce or gold standard for that kind of work, made a very large amount of money, but ultimately paid the price for doing it. And that is the concern, the exodus of clients that these public relations firms are clearly thinking of.
And we've been speaking to one public relations expert, haven't we?
We have indeed. Eileen Wallace has joined us in the studio, managing partner of Wallace PR. It's an independent public relations company based here in Dubai, been around for about 20 years or so. And we asked her about this moral, ethical dilemma. Isn't it the job of PR companies, we said to her, to help people, companies, countries when they're in trouble in the way that lawyers help people out when they're in trouble?
I think the majority of PR companies operate from the perspective that all governments, individuals, companies should ideally have a platform to be heard. Everyone has a story to tell, whether you're a commercial entity, whether you're a nonprofit entity, whether you're a private individual. If you have a story to tell, PR companies can be engaged to help you strategically shape that story and find the right outlet to tell that story. But that doesn't mean that PR companies are obligated to take on work that makes them uncomfortable or they feel that is at odds with the ethos of how they do business.
We also asked Eileen, would she have accepted the Hong Kong job if it were offered to her?
I don't think I would have accepted that job. I feel confident we wouldn't have accepted that job, because when there are fundamental structural issues, in this case, public policy issues, safety issues that need to be addressed first, that is the primary concern. So at the end of the day, PR is not wallpaper that you can use, or communication is not wallpaper that you can use to paper over fundamentally faulty construction. So I don't think that's something we would have taken on.
Well, we've had a lot of people messaging us with their opinions and their own moral dilemmas. Shabna has been in touch. She is not sure that there actually is a right answer to the question.
Well, I would probably turn down an offer if it doesn't suit my ethical reasons. But we've had this kind of discussions in the past. You know, we've had projects and we've had team members who seem to have disagreed to, you know, the views of the others. So basically what I've kind of understood is that, you know, it depends on the Machiavellian scores as well. You know, it's a kind of a test where if you have a high score, then it probably means that, you know, you don't care so much about the ethical values. And if it's a low score, it probably means that you have a higher ethical value.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai I 103.8.
A very good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap with me, Richard Dean. Talking about the finances of football now, because tonight is the first night of the new UAE Emirati football season. To get us in the mood, this was the moment at the end of last season where Sharjah became unlikely winners.
Allah!
Ah, you can't beat Arabic football commentary. Or maybe you can, because in a bid to attract more expats to the game, the Arabian Gulf League is now making sure that all of the TV games have not only Arabic commentary, but also English commentary. This is Waleed Hassani. He's the CEO of the UAE Pro League. And this, he says, is how they're planning to attract more fans to the games.
We need to enhance the match experience when it comes to parking, signage, when it comes to ticketing, how easy they can access to the stadium, and how they can find the seats. Now we have an online system. We will enhance the facilities that can show the fans where they can sit, where they can reach their near location for the stadium. The other area is going to be the stadium facilities, which has will focus on the food quality, fan zone, the interaction with the fans. And of course, there will be a reward for the fans that come to the matches. We managed to get 30 Audi car, model A3. There will be 2 cars per club, so we have 14 clubs. Each club fans will be eligible to win 2 cars per season.
And of course, English language commentary. Chris McCarty is one of those commentators, our own Chris McCarty. He's going to be with us in the studio. Now we're going to speak to Andrew Moroney, who is a lawyer with Al Tamimi. He's a former lawyer for the Football Association in the United Kingdom and something of an expert in sports law and the commercial realities of sport, Andrew. So the UAE Football League wants to expand its reach and attract more sports fans. What does it have to do, in your view, to achieve this goal?
Well, I think Waleed's obviously touched on a couple of points in that little clip there. I think that for me, and my experience coming from the English game, and what I've noticed in my year and a half out in the Middle East so far, is to get the basics right. I think there's you've got to be really realistic about your targets. Obviously, the temptation is just to try and copy a model that's already out there, for example, the English Premier League. But in your ability to get that, it's great to think big, but the journey is a lot of small steps. So that getting the basics right, so scheduling and getting communications piece correct in terms of letting people know when games are taking place, and sticking to schedules. And I've heard anecdotally that sometimes kickoff times get moved for unknown reasons. But if the communication piece is correct and the penetration to all the fans is there, then you can obviously engage the largest audience. And I think that's obviously a key part of the growing the game here, is to increase the attendances reliably. I think broader than that, I think whatever you do, it has to be with a view to your base. And by base, I mean your participation base and also your fan base. All steps you take, whether they're expensive or inexpensive, should be with a view to increasing participation in the lower game, because ultimately they're the stars of the future, and also growing your fan base, because ultimately that's where your commercial revenues derive from. And perhaps a little example about that would be, from my background, would be the St. George's Park National Training Centre that the English Football Association invested in and signed off back in the 2008-2009, which came online in 2012. That was a hugely expensive project, and it was not universally popular from a political point of view, and it ran over budget and was a little bit late. However, that £130 million that was spent on that project...
Which is what, about 700 million dirhams? So that's a significant amount of money.
A huge chunk of change, yes. And it's, some people thought the location was a bit strange because they popped in the centre of England. So historically, Wembley and the FA has been based in London. It's very London-centric. But if you put a new national training centre in the middle of the country, would that tally in with the national stadium? Would it harmonise? Would there be synergies there? Obviously, the thinking there was that you should be able to appeal to anyone around the country, and therefore you've put something in the middle of the country.
But it's worked, hasn't it? Because England's producing some cracking young players now, which it hasn't done for a long time.
And that's it. And you have a time lag before you see the change that you're investing in. So if you come online in 2012 and you spend a lot of money on it, people expect to see results relatively quickly. The reality is that if you're pushing through a cohort of players who start in the age group categories at sort of 15, 16, it's going to take a while for them to make an impact in the higher age category teams, so the 18s, 19s, 20s, 21s, and then obviously ultimately the senior game. But you're right, 2017 marked, it was actually incredibly well timed, probably accidentally, that the 2017 cohort that was coming through was really the first generation that had always been St. George's based. And that allowed the FA training teams, the coaches and the managers there, to ingrain a DNA, which is that all the teams at St. George's Park play in the same way. So they have the same setup, same formation. The coaching style is identical. So if you move from the 16s, 17s, the 18s, you're playing in exactly the same way.
Very quickly, producing homegrown talent is one thing. Signing talent is another thing. And you say there's been a shift in mentality among UAE clubs. From what to what?
Well, I think historically, and this is a model that's actually replicated to some extent in the States, there's been a focus on signing household names. So people who are perhaps towards the end of their career that can give an immediate boost to the PR of the local football industry. So, for example, you could say players like Beckham in the States when he went to LA Galaxy, a fairly nascent league out there. However, obviously, brand Beckham put a huge amount of interest and focus on the league out there. Over here, to the same extent you've had, as good the management side, someone like Maradona going to Al Wasl, that obviously had it did spike the attendances at Al Wasl. But with a view to creating a sustainable growth, is attracting marquee names necessarily the way to go? So the shift has been towards focusing more on players in their prime rather than established household names.
Andrew Moroney, associate at the law firm Altamimi, appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
A very good evening. I'm Richard Dean, and you're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. We are talking football, and that is because the new UAE football season begins. Joining us in the studio to shed some light on this is our very own Chris McCarty, head of sport here at the Arabian Radio Network and presenter of Off Script. Good to see you.
It's nice to see you too. How was the Oval?
Oh, the Oval, the cricket was fabulous.
Good.
Thoroughly enjoyed that. But we move very quickly onto domestic sport. So tell us what's different about this year's Emirati Football League, in very simple terms, for people who aren't a regular
for
watcher.
For a start, I think the key initiative this season is that every match will be available in English commentary, which is great to see. I think it's finally reaching out to an expat community. We've talked at length over the years about the lack of attendances. Let's not dress it up. There is a lack of attendances at the stadium. So that's one small part, I think, in getting expats involved in this league. There's still an awful lot to go for that. I think the other thing this season is incredibly competitive. You look at the teams this year, Al Jazeera, Al Wahda, Al Ain, the most successful club of all with 13 league titles. I think we're going to be in for a very competitive campaign, and we've got a number of excellent foreign players, the leader of which is Alvaro Negredo. Now, foreign players have always been intrinsic to this league, but this season, more than any other, with the fact that there's an English kind of component to it all, I think we're going to see attendances grow, and I think we're in for a very good season indeed.
Do you feel that just the fact that people can watch television with English commentary enables them to get into the games, and that will lead to them actually going to the stadiums?
Absolutely. Again, I think there are big plans from the league, not just this season, but over the course of the next few seasons. Marketing is key. We know that. Fixture timings. Do they do enough to put that out into the market? I've got my doubts. Do they have big plans this season to really promote that? Yes, they do. I think it's a kind of small step approach this year. I'm involved, Tom Uckert's involved, Robbie Greenfield's involved. They've got a number of media individuals involved to try and grow it, to try and get that message out there, because the league is accessible. The tickets are not expensive. You can get tickets for as little as 10 dirhams. And I promise you, having watched this league kind of grow over the course of the past 9 years, the standard is there. The talent is very much there.
Brandy Scott is ahead of the curve. She's had an Al Nasser shirt, isn't it?
I have, and I've gone to a game.
Yeah.
You have, Brandy, and you're coming with us as well, because we've started up a little supporters club this year. We picked a club, myself and my friends. It's growing. We put it out there on Off Script. We had about 20 text messages in the other night of people saying, hey guys, I'll put my hand up to this. I'll come and follow Al Nasser. We chose Al Nasser, the blue wave, your side, Brandy, because we want to have fun. We want to create that match day experience that you and I, Richard, grew up with over in the UK, where you may perhaps find a bar, you find a restaurant before a game, you pop on down, you get involved, you sing the songs, and at the end of it, you shake hands and you go away having enjoyed a good night of the football.
So, in terms of the commentary, how do we watch the games and listen to you, Tom, Robbie, do the English commentary, many, many others as well?
Abu Dhabi Sports, Dubai Sports, Sharjah Sports. Locally, boots on ground, it's the three big main TV stations. What I should point out as well is the league are actually going global this season as well. So, and there may be out there that think, who will be watching it there? It's going into America, it's going into Scandinavia, Australia and New Zealand this year as well. So the league have done a great job in getting broadcasters on board to promote the league worldwide as well. Yes, it's baby steps to start with, but it's still a move in the right direction, no doubt about it.
Dubai Sports, Abu Dhabi Sports,
yes,
Sharjah Sports. It's free to air.
It certainly is. It's games across the weekend, so it's Thursday nights and Friday nights. That was a conscious decision by the organisers. They can't compete, let's be frank. They can't compete with the English Premier League, La Liga, Serie A, Bundesliga, Liga A. So they made the decision. The weekend here is Friday, Saturday. Thursday night games, Friday games. The featured matches, more often than not, will be on a Friday evening to try and tent the expats out. The weekend starts, as we know, from about 5:36, 8 o'clock for us in our case this evening. As soon as the weekend kicks off, get down to a football match and enjoy it.
But what salary range are these professional footballers on?
Some of them are on top cash. Some of them are on money that would rival what they're earning back in England, Spain. Alvaro Negredo, I'm not privy to exactly what he earns, but I know in the past, for example, Asamoah Gyan, a Ghanaian international, played with Al Ain, former Sunderland man. Came over here and he was earning approximately £60,000 per week. So what's that? It's about 300,000 dirhams per week up in the Garden City. So it's big money. The lesser lights, they're still taking home 20, 25, 30,000 dirhams, that is, a week. Good money.
I think one of the criticisms always been levelled at the league and other leagues around the world is that you're getting people at the tail end of their career when they're on the decline. Is that still the case?
It isn't. And I've often said this. It really annoys me when people say that. A few examples. You look at Kiki Sanchez-Flores, now manager of Watford. He had a spell over here with Al Ahly and Al Ain. Ryan Babel, a failure up at Al Ain, now playing Champions League football last night for Galatasaray, was scoring goals for the Netherlands in international football just last week. Ricardo Quaresma, the Portuguese international, a failure down at the Rashid Stadium with Al Ahly, now a man still scoring goals for Portugal in the World Cup finals last year. So yes, there are some quote unquote older has-beens that arrive here. Not all do well, and some in actual fact don't do well, go back to these big leagues in Europe and actually flourish. So you still need the mentality of a professional footballer. You still have to work hard. And in some cases, players have struggled here, gone back and gone on to do wonders back in European football.
While you're here, very quickly, want to talk to you about the Rugby World Cup, which also begins this weekend. Before I get your thoughts, Chris, this is Jern Schlimm. He's the co-founder and managing partner of Balympics International, which is a sports consultancy here in the UAE. And we asked him, in global commercial terms, how big is the Rugby World Cup compared to, say, FIFA or ICC cricket or the Masters Golf? And we'll hear from him in a couple of minutes. But first of all, Chris, your thoughts on that subject. Rugby World Cup?
Rugby World, it's not as big. There's no doubt in my mind it's not as big as the FIFA World Cup from a football standpoint. Is it as big as the Masters Golf? It probably is. I mean, it's a global event, right? We've got the New Zealands, the Australias, South Africas of this world. I'm really excited about this World Cup. It all kicks off tomorrow. It is Japan, the hosts, taking on Russia. And then Saturday, it is the superest of super Saturdays. What is it? Australia, Fiji, 8:45. France, Argentina, 11:15. And then the biggie at 1:45. It is South Africa against Brandy's beloved All Blacks. Cannot wait for this. It's 6 weeks, and fingers crossed Scotland can at least make the quarterfinals.
You've had a couple of good games against Georgia recently, a couple of warm-ups in the last couple
of weeks. We struggled on one of those, yeah. Malcolm. I've got a feeling Scotland have stagnated a little bit. I'm fearful. We're in Pool A alongside Ireland, who I know a lot of people are fancying to go all the way. We're also in Pool A with Japan, the host. And I hate to say this, and I'm hoping there's not many Scots listening, I've got a feeling that Scotland may not get out of their pool.
Oh.
I think it may be Japan that finished second in that group.
Well, looking at the economics of it all and the commercial angles of it, this is Jern Schlimm of Balympics International. How big is the Rugby World Cup?
If we talk about the importance of the Rugby World Cup, it's not easy to compare it to other major sporting events, for example, the FIFA World Cup, the ICC Cricket, or the FIBA Basketball World Cup that just completed in China. So we have to look at different factors, actually. There are different factors to evaluate the size and the commercial importance of major sporting events. So for instance, you have the global fan base and audience, the viewership on TV, TV rights deals, popularity on the internet, and other new indicators such as the presence on social media, for example, the number of likes, the interactions overall that a major sporting event receives. Or you got the number of professionals actually playing that sport, or the number of people engaged in the sport.
We do finally have a Middle East TV deal for the Rugby World Cup signed just last week at the 11th hour, Chris.
Sorry, we do indeed. Yes, beIN Sports has got the rights to this. The good news is, I am told that it will be free. Well, as long as you've got your normal package, you won't have to layer the subscription with extra cash involved. So it will be on beIN Sports. It was an 11th hour deal. Of course, OSN, no longer a sports provider. There was a lot of panic on the text lines. Where is the Rugby World Cup going to be shown? The good news, it is on beIN Sports. So if you don't have it, make sure you get it, subscribe to it. World Cup is on our screens for the next 6 weeks.
And I'm sure that most of the venues around town will be showing it as well.
well.
Oh, yes.
Big time, yeah.
The grill at Barasti is going to be quite tasty, isn't it, on Saturday?
It's going to be absolutely jumping.
Stay tuned to Dubai Eye for details of that. Chris McCarty is the presenter of Offscript, head of sports here at the Arabian Radio Network. Appreciate your time.
Dot man, thank you.
That's it for the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back live on air Sunday morning from 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.